This is KLOI LP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And we're here in the studio this morning with Richard Fagan and another episode of This Strange and Wonderful World. And if you've been following along with Richard, you know that we're going sailing again. Tell us where we're going today, Richard.
Well, actually, we're going around the world eventually.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, this is a big journey.
It's a big journey.
Yeah, get comfortable.
In real life, it took 3 years and 2 months, but we'll try and do it in substantially less than that.
Okay.
We're going to talk about Joshua Slocum, a name probably familiar to some of you, who wrote classic book called Sailing Alone Around the World. He was the first man to circumnavigate the globe alone. As I mentioned, it took him 3 years, 2 months, and some days. And it issued, published in 1900, in an absolutely classic book called Sailing Alone Around the World, which has been in continuous print now for 109 years. And it's very interesting case, not just the voyage, but the man himself, because he was basically unschooled. And I'll talk a little bit about how he got from being an unschooled young man to this guy who could write this absolutely classic prose telling a classic adventure tale. He was born in Nova Scotia. He was the fifth of 11 children of a farm family. Now, they were, of course, Canadians, being born in Nova Scotia, but in a real sense, they were Yankees, because he came from English stock that had emigrated to Massachusetts, so his grandparents were in Massachusetts, but at the time, or maybe his great-grandparents, I'm not sure, but at the time of the Revolutionary War, they were loyalists, and so they fled to Canada and never really completely lost their New England ways and roots. He left school at 10 when his family fell on hard times. Now, he's the fifth of 11 children, and that was not an easy brood to feed. They were a farm family. His father was not a particularly successful farmer. So little Joshua left school at 10, never went back to formal school anyway, and he never learned how to spell or punctuate properly. And when he wrote, and he wrote quite a bit, his material was always sent to an editor, cleaned up, and the words weren't changed. But so when you read Sailing Alone Around the World or some of his other things, you're not going to find misspellings and bad punctuation because it's been cleaned up. But the words are all his. The words weren't cleaned up. Now, he went to work with his father after he left school, making fishermen's boots. They were leather boots. He was right at Wharfside there in Nova Scotia, and he fell in love with the sea. Hated making boots, but he loved the sea. So at 14, basically, he ran away. And he ran away to sea. And he signed on as a cook and a seaman on a fishing schooner. He was not a successful cook. He came back to land, signed on again as a seaman on a British ship bound for Liverpool. He was 16 when he did that, and by the time he was 18, he was second mate. And, of course, to be a mate meant that you had to learn navigation, not only shipboard ways and all sorts of things, seamanship, but navigation, which he taught himself. He was an avid reader, what today we'd call a quick study, and by the time he was 25, he was offered the command of an American coasting schooner that went up and down from Maine to New York. And so in 1869, at 25, he became Captain Slocum. And that's the title that he used for the rest of his life, whether he was the captain of a ship or not. Even when he was on land, he was called Captain Slocum. He applied for and received American citizenship, fairly easy to do since he had this American New England background anyway. And from that point, he sailed as a Yankee skipper. Seafaring led to romance. He met and wooed a woman by the name of Virginia Walker, sailed with her to Australia, and married her there in Australia in 1871. Now, Virginia was quite amazing woman. She was evidently very spunky. She had some Native American blood in her, and She bore him 7 children, all of whom were either born at sea, because she, wherever he sailed, she sailed with him. They were basically never apart. Some were born at sea, and some were born on land, but if born on land, they were all born in foreign ports. None were born in the United States. There was a pair of there were twins in there. They died very young. Another child died. So 4 of the 7 children survived to adulthood. Now, from 1872 to 1892, for 20 years, Slocum sailed as a captain, all kinds of vessels all over the world. And this is a very, very interesting history. Don't have time to go into it now, but suffice it to say that just about anything that could befall a seafaring man, he experienced. He commanded huge windjammers, small sailing vessels. He lost cargoes, made large profits, slipped into near bankruptcy, sailed from Brazil to the United States with his family in a 35-foot junk rig boat that he'd built on a beach in Brazil after losing his own ship. He was a part-time correspondent for the San Francisco Bee, local newspaper, fought pirates, mutiny, storms, suffered 3 shipwrecks, etc., etc.
And most of that with his wife and children. Is that accurate? Or
we'll get there.
Oh, okay.
Some of it with the wife and children, some of it with a second wife.
Oh, okay.
Because in Buenos Aires, on July 25th, 1884, his beloved soulmate and shipmate, Virginia, the mother of the 7 children, not yet 35 years old, died of a fever and a weakened heart. So he lost Virginia in Buenos Aires. He was completely undone. He later described his condition as having gone crazy. He ran his ship ashore in desperation, an act of craziness, almost lost her there, rescued her. Years later, his second son wrote, "Father's days were done with the passing of mother. When she died, father never recovered. He was like a ship with a broken rudder." He married again. 2 years after Virginia died, he married Hetty Elliott. She was 24. She was a first cousin from Nova Scotia. And she actually accompanied him on this remarkable voyage from Brazil back to Boston on this ship, really a boat, a junk rig that he built on the Brazilian beach. It was Hetty and 2 of his children, and he sailed it back. He reported this voyage in his first book called The Voyage of the Liberdade, or Liberdade in Portuguese. It was named Liberdade, which is liberty, because she was launched on the day on which Brazil abolished slavery. So she was named Liberty for that purpose. But Hetty hated this voyage, never went to sea again, remained in the shadow of Virginia's memory for the rest of their life together, and they didn't spend much of that life together, as we'll see. So now begins the period in which Spray, the boat which he took around the world, was born. It's December 1892. Slocum is 49 years old. He was wandering alone on the Boston waterfront, and here's how Slocum describes what happened in its aftermath, wandering around. By the way, everything I'll read from now on that's in his words comes from sailing alone around the world. You should also know that Slocum had a chance to make the transition from sail to steam, because it was just at an age when that transition was being made. It was, after all, well after the Civil War. He absolutely refused to do it. He would not have anything to do with steam. And by virtue of not having anything to do with steam, he basically ended his career as a big ship captain, because there were very few large sailing ships left at that time. Okay, here's how he describes what happened on and then after this encounter on the Boston waterfront. He says, "I met an old acquaintance, a whaling captain, who said, 'Come to Fairhaven and I'll give you a ship.' But," he added, She wants some repairs. The captain's terms, when fully explained, were more than satisfactory to me. They included all the assistance I'd require to fit the craft for sea. I was only too glad to accept, for I had already found that I could not obtain work in the shipyard without first paying $50 to a society. And as for a ship to command, there were not enough ships to go around. I should mention that in addition to his other talents, Slocum was a very accomplished shipwright. He had, after all, built the Libertad on the beach in Pernambuco and sailed it up to Boston. So he was very, extremely good with his hands, as we'll see. He continues, "The next day I landed at Fairhaven, opposite New Bedford, found that my friend had something of a joke on me. For 7 years the joke had been on him. The ship, in quotation marks, proved to be a very antiquated sloop called the Spray, which the neighbors declared had been built in the year one. She was affectionately propped up in a field some distance from salt water and was covered with canvas. The day I appeared, there was a buzz at the gossip exchange. At last, someone had come and was actually at work on the old Spray. Breaking her up, I suppose? No, going to rebuild her. Great was the amazement. Will it pay? Was the question which, for a year or more, I answered by declaring that I would make it pay." Now, this guy, this is where he shows that he is a real New England Yankee. Remember, no power tools, and he's working alone, okay, or alone most of the time. "My axe felled a stout oak tree nearby for a keel, and Farmer Howard, for a small sum of money, hauled in this and other timbers for the frame of the new vessel. I rigged a steam box and a pot for a boiler. The timbers for ribs, being straight saplings, were dressed and steamed till supple, then bent over a log where they were secured till set. Something tangible appeared every day to show for my labor, and the neighbors made the work sociable. It was a great day in the Spray shipyard when her new stem was set up and fastened to the new keel." Now, again, Fagan interjecting something. This is a rebuild of the Spray, but basically it's a new boat, because all the crucial timbers were replaced. Everything was replaced. So we take off a piece, make a new one, fasten it, and keep going. So in the end, the boat that he had was the same shape as the Spray, but it wasn't the Spray. It was the Spray we bought. He continues, "Better timber for a ship than pasture white oak never grew. The breast hooks as well as all her ribs were of this wood and were steamed and bent into shape as required. It was hard upon March when I began working in earnest. The weather was cold, still there were plenty of inspectors to back me with advice. From the deck of the new craft, I could put out my hand and pick cherries that grew over a little grave. The planks for the new vessel, which I soon came to put on, were of Georgia pine, an inch and a half thick. The operation of putting them on was tedious, but when on, the caulking was easy." Now, I should mention that the Spray's 37 feet long. So she's as long as, I would say, the average small cruiser or recreational tug, you know, that we see around here in Fish Bay. And as we go through some of the rebuilding, you'll see how unbelievably heavily she was built. "The deck I made of 1.5-inch by 3-inch white pine, spiked to beams." These are the deck beams. 6 by 6 inches of yellow or Georgia pine, placed 3 feet apart." Fagan again. This is a deck on which elephants could dance.
And all of this, what he's talking about, was standing timber.
All standing timber.
He took it down with an axe.
Right. So some of it was clearly put in green, although he was at this for a long time, so it also had some time to season. "The deck enclosures were one over the aperture of the main hatch, 6 by 6 for a cooking galley, and a trunk for the raft about 10 feet by 12 for a cabin. Both of these rose about 3 feet above the deck and were sunk sufficiently into the hold to afford headroom." Now, we can't show a picture of the Spray, but if we had a picture, what you'd see is that today she's basically what we'd call flush deck. In other words, she didn't have a deck house sticking above. What she had were these high hatches. Now, they were 3 feet high, but they were still basically hatches, just enough to give headroom. This meant that in a sea that swept over the deck, there was very little to be carried away, because it wasn't like there was a big deck house or a cabin there or anything that could be battered. These were close to the deck. Two coats of copper paint were slapped on the bottom, two of white lead on the topside and bulwarks. The rudder was shipped and painted, and the following day the spray was launched. As she rode at her ancient, rust-eaten anchor, she sat on the water like a swan. The spray's dimensions were, when finished, 36 feet 9 inches long overall, 14 feet 2 inches wide, and 4 feet 2 inches deep. Then the mast, a smart New Hampshire spruce, was fitted, and likewise all the small appurtenances necessary for a short cruise. Sails were bent, and away she flew with my friend Captain Pierce and me across Buzzard's Bay on a trial trip. Fagan again, eat your heart out, local boat builders. The cost of my new vessel was $553.62 for materials and 13 months of my own labor. Now,
13 months doesn't seem that long.
No, he was a prodigious worker. I mean, this is evident all through the whole thing. And he worked right through the winter. I mean, it didn't make any difference that it was winter. He was out there every day. Now, he continues in his book about his attempt to become a fisherman with his craft, because the original spray was a fishing boat. And so he was going to go fishing. Here's what he says. I spent a season in my new craft fishing on the coast, only to find that I had not the cunning properly to bait a hook. But at last the time arrived to weigh anchor and get to sea in earnest. I'd resolved on a voyage around the world. And as the wind on the morning of April 24th, 1895 was fair, at noon I weighed anchor, set sail, and filled away from Boston, where the spray had been moored snugly all winter. The 12 o'clock whistles were blowing just as the sloop shot ahead under full sail. Then, my step was light on deck in the crisp air. I felt that there could be no turning back and that I was engaged in an adventure, the meaning of which I thoroughly understood. I had taken little advice from anyone, for I had a right to my own opinions in matters pertaining to the sea. Now, let's take a little closer look at spray before we start out around the world. As we said before, she was about 37 feet overall, 14-foot beam plus, which made her rather chunky. She was a chunky vessel. Her hull enclosed a lot of space. She drew a bit over 4 feet. She had these two low deck houses we mentioned about. And on deck, between the two deck houses, the two big hatches, she carried an 8-foot dory. Now, this is typical Slocum. 8-foot dories weren't made. So he took a 16-foot dory, he cut it in half, boarded up the cut, and he now had an 8-foot dory, which was half of, because that was about all he could manage on a boat this size. She was steered by a wheel running to pulleys aft, which all of that stuff was above deck, so very easy to look at and to repair if anything went wrong. And at the waterline, despite the fact that she had a big transom on her, she was almost a true double-ender, which meant that in following seas, because of this slim waterline aft, she would rise on a following sea rather than being batted around by it. To settle her down, she was ballasted with 3 tons of concrete. This was also fairly common at the time. She didn't have what today we would call a deep keel. She just had a keel running the length of the boat, integral to the hull, nothing hanging down. And all boats were ballasted of that kind, were ballasted, often sometimes just with beach rocks. They just throw big boulders in there till she settled on her waterline in the right place.
I think the boulders could move, though, quite a bit in the high seas, couldn't they?
Well, if they use boulders and... This is another story, but some of the fishing boats carried these boulders. And what they did, when they caught 100 pounds of fish, they threw a 100-pound boulder over. So they always stayed with the same weight in the hold.
Wow.
And if they could carry 3 tons of fish, they came back at the beach with 3 tons of fish and no boulders. And since they were on the beach, they just put the boulders out. But they went out. But that wasn't the case of the spray.
I know. That's an interesting story.
Yeah. She was originally rigged as a sloop with a gaff mainsail. In other words, that sort of not quite, I guess it's a trapezoid, isn't it? You know, anyway, with a gaff rig, a jib set on a long bowsprit sticking out in front. In South American waters, he chopped off the front of the bowsprit, and he stepped a small mast aft, right at the transom, a mizzen mast, and he put out a boomkin. For those of you who don't know what a boomkin is like a bowsprit, except that it sticks out from the transom. It goes aft, and this enables a sail to be sheeted out after the transom. Okay, he put up a small mizzen sail, and this turned her into a yawl. Now, the yawl is an easier boat to balance and sail, because when it really gets rough, you drop the mainsail, don't have any mainsail at all. You have your little mizzen sail up, you have a small jib up, and you have very little sail, but the sails are out, one far forward, one far aft, and it's a much safer and more tranquil rig. Now, here you get a sense of what kind of guy Slocum had become as he approached his 50th birthday. Here are some of the holdings in the library that he took aboard Spray. Remember, this is a guy who left formal schooling when he was 10 years old, fourth grade maybe, something like that. The library included books by Darwin, Macaulay's History of England, Washington Irving's Life of Columbus, Don Quixote, books by Mark Twain and Robert Louis Stevenson, a complete Shakespeare, poetry by Burns, Tennyson, and Longfellow. And this from a man who left school when he was 10. So he's an autodidact. Now, at the start of the voyage, he sailed first to Gloucester, you know, which is just up from Boston, for a final outfitting, and then to the harbor of Yarmouth, which is also in Massachusetts, which is his jumping-off point for crossing the Atlantic and really starting his round-the-world voyage. And here's a classic passage about getting his clock, which he used for navigation. He said, I spent some days pleasantly enough in Yarmouth. Took in some butter for the voyage, also a barrel of potatoes. Filled 6 barrels of water, stowed all under deck. At Yarmouth, too, I got my famous tin clock, the only timepiece I carried on the whole voyage. The price of it was $1.50, but on account of the face being smashed, the merchant let me have it for $1. Now, I think many of you probably know that since the late 1700s, the way in which a ship at sea fixed how far north or south it was, in other words, what its latitude was, by using a very fine timepiece that kept accurate time, so you could compare your local time with your shot of the sun and with the time of Greenwich, and that would tell you how far, excuse me, I meant to say how far east or west you were. Now, he didn't have that. He had a fine timepiece, but it had salted up, and he said it was going to cost $15 to repair it, and he didn't want to spend the $15. So he set sail with his tin clock, and that was the clock he used. Now, basically, it was no darn good for navigation because it wasn't nearly accurate enough for that. So what he did was he used it just to keep track of local time. He would reset it to the local time zone, and it gave him within 5-10 minutes local time. So the navigational question, which I'll talk about in a minute, was something that is almost unimaginable because although he had a sextant, and obviously he knew how to use it very well, the sextant wasn't terribly useful without an accurate timepiece because
where was he?
Yeah, he couldn't determine his longitude, his distance east or west. Now, latitude, how far you are north and south, is fairly easy to do with shots from stars. You know, the North Star tells us directly what latitude we're at, but the longitude was another question. He wasn't long at sea in the Atlantic before he was beset by loneliness. And here's his entry from the book about loneliness. Still in the dismal fog, I felt myself drifting into loneliness, an insect on a straw in the midst of the elements. I lashed the helm, and my vessel held her course, and while she sailed, I slept. During these days, a feeling of awe crept over me. My memory worked with startling power. The ominous, the insignificant, the great, the small, the wonderful, the commonplace, all appeared before my mental vision in magical succession. Pages of my history were recalled, which had been so long forgotten that they seemed to belong to a previous existence. I heard all the voices of the past, laughing, crying, telling what I had heard them tell in many corners of the earth. The loneliness of my state wore off when the gale was high and I found much work to do. When fine weather returned, then came the sense of solitude, which I could not shake off. I used my voice often, at first giving some order about the affairs of a ship, for I had been told that from disuse I should lose my speech. At the meridian altitude of the sun, I called aloud, "Eight bells!" after the custom on a ship at sea. Again from my cabin I cried to an imaginary man at the helm, "How does she head there?" And again, "Is she on her course?" But getting no reply, I was reminded the more palpably of my condition. My voice sounded hollow on the empty air, and I dropped the practice. However, it was not long before the thought came to me that when I was a lad I used to sing. Why not try that now, where it would disturb no one? My musical talent had never bred envy in others, but out on the Atlantic, to realize what it meant, you should have heard me sing. You should have seen the porpoises leap when I pitched my voice for the waves and sea and all that was in it.
That's a great sentence.
Isn't that terrific? You know, and again, here's the guy with a fourth grade education.
I know.
Now, I can't read everything that I want to read because we'd be here for a long time. But he has a wonderful passage about an encounter with a turtle. Because, of course, out in the Atlantic, the sea turtles float on the surface, breathing, resting, etc. And although he didn't much like to kill things, of course, he was never hungry, but he wanted fresh meat. So he killed the turtle. And he said, "The turtle steak was good. I found no fault with the cook. And it was the rule of the voyage that the cook found no fault with me. There was never a ship's crew so well agreed. The bill of fare that evening was turtle steak, tea and toast, fried potatoes, stewed onions, with dessert of stewed pears and cream." And you get a sense there of he had a certain kind of Yankee wit about him. And it's laced all through the book, these little cracks and asides. They're not really sarcasm, they're little ironies, you know, which is little digs at himself and at
right.
You know,
well, and he talked about himself in the third person, and that was a way of creating company in a way.
That's
he had a companion.
That's right. Now, he sailed. He landed when he crossed the Atlantic in Gibraltar, and he had originally thought about going on, heading east, going through the Mediterranean. Going around the Cape of Good Hope and making his trip with an eastern route. But he encountered pirates just off Gibraltar, and it scared the devil out of him. And he was saved, actually, by a storm, which tipped over the capsized the pirate vessel and allowed him to escape. And after many adventures, so he decided to come back across the Atlantic and sail in the other direction. In other words, sail to the west. So he crossed the Atlantic, and he came eventually, of course, to the Straits of Magellan and Cape Horn. He decided to go through the Straits of Magellan, and there he encountered, for those of you with long memories, the people that we talked about in the little presentation about Darwin and the Fuegians, the people who live in Tierra del Fuego, and he didn't like them. He found them sort of barbarous savages, and at one point, after several encounters with them, he had been advised, since they snuck up on Little Spray at night in their canoes and boarded the Spray, he was advised to spread tacks on the deck. So he spread tacks all over the deck, slept soundly. And here's his little description of what happened when he was moored there. He says, "Now it's well known that one cannot step on a tack without saying something about it. A pretty good Christian will whistle when he steps on the commercial end of a carpet tack. A savage will howl and claw the air. And that was just what happened that night about 12 o'clock while I was asleep in the cabin, where the savages thought they, quote, had me, sloop and all, but changed their minds when they stepped on deck, for then they thought that I or somebody else had them. I had no need of a dog. They howled like a pack of hounds. I had hardly use for a gun. They jumped pell-mell, some into their canoes, some into the sea, to cool off. And there was a great deal of free language over it as they went. I fired several guns when I came on deck to let the rascals know that I was home. Then I turned in again, feeling sure I should not be disturbed any more by people who left in so great a hurry." So he makes it through the Strait of Magellan eventually, and he's now in the Pacific. He stops at Isla Juan Fernandez Island, which is off the coast of Chile, quite far south. That's Robinson Crusoe Island. It's the island and a castaway that inspired the story of Robinson Crusoe. And then he set sail. It took him 72 days to cross the Pacific to Samoa. Much of this time, the helm was lashed. He sailed for days on end in the trade winds with the helm lashed, and when the spray would fall a little bit, you know, off the wind or on the wind, it would correct itself and go back on course. So he had plenty of time to read, plenty of time to write, plenty of time to rest. And he wrote about the magic of it all. Quote, "I was en rapport, with my surroundings, and was carried on a vast stream where I felt the buoyancy of His hand, capitalized, who made all the worlds. I realized the mathematical truth of their motions, so well known that astronomers compiled tables of their positions through the years and the days and the minutes of a day with such precision that one coming along over the sea even 5 years later may, by their aid, find the standard time of any given meridian on Earth." But of course, he wasn't doing that. What he did do one time in the 72 days is he shot something called a lunar reckoning. Now, lunar reckonings had gone out of style about 80 or 90 years before this. They are immensely complicated. What you do is you shoot on a given day, at a given time, the altitude of the moon, and there is a complex set of tables which can tell you where you are based on what you find with your sextant shooting the moon. It's a very complicated mathematical, and it's so tedious, as I say, that it wasn't used at all. So anyway, he shot a lunar reckoning, and he found out where he was, and it agreed within 5 miles of where he had charted on the plot using only dead reckoning. And dead reckoning in this case means that you take a compass course, you plot it, you throw out your log to get the speed of how fast you're going, you allow for drift, you allow for current, then you put a point on the map, which is your best guess. Dead reckoning actually has nothing to do with being dead. It comes from the expression deduced reckoning. So you deduce where you are and put a point on the map, and the next day you do the same thing. And of course, when you're dead reckoning and you don't have any corrections, the error can build up, well, arithmetically. Every day you're a little off, and the next day you're more off and more off and more off. So here he's out 43 days from the last landfall. His dead reckoning and his lunar reckoning are within 5 miles of each other. Now that's magic. It's instinct, you know. It's quite incredible. Anyway, he eventually arrives in Australia. By the way, when he was in Samoa, he met Robert Louis Stevenson's widow. The widow gave him some of Robert Louis Stevenson's maritime books, which Bray much treasured. Anyway, he arrives in Australia. From Australia, he sails to South Africa. He's going to go, of course, around the Cape of Good Hope. And there, he meets the famous English explorer H.M. Stanley, known to us basically, since we don't much study this kind of stuff, for his famous alleged greeting when he was sent to find David Livingstone. And he finally found him and said, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume?" Anyway, that's Stanley. And here's how... Here's how Slocum writes about encountering Stanley. He said, "I hauled close to the wind to go slow, for Mr. Stanley was a nautical man once himself, and of course my desire was to appear in the best light before a man of his experience." Parentheses. You can almost feel the tongue in the cheek at this point. "He looked me over carefully and said, 'What an example of patience!' 'Patience is all that's required,' I ventured to reply. He then asked if my vessel had watertight compartments. I explained that she was all watertight and all compartment. 'What if she should strike a rock?' he asked. 'Compartments would not save her if she should hit the rocks lying along our course,' said I, adding, 'She must be kept away from the rocks.' After a considerable pause, Mr. Stanley asked, 'What if a swordfish should pierce her hull with its sword?' Of course, I had thought of that as one of the dangers of the sea, and also the chance of being struck by lightning. In the case of the swordfish, I ventured to say, 'The first thing would be to secure the sword.'"
That's great.
So that's Mr. Slocum. Now, he's rounded the Cape, and he's on his way back to the United States. The end of the voyage is, in a way, in sight, although he's still thousands of miles from Boston. And there's a very, very funny episode at St. Helena, which is the island, you know, out there in the middle of the Atlantic, where they sent Napoleon into exile. And he is given a goat as a present. Slocum had refused to sail with deck animals, with chickens, with pigs, with all sorts of live animals that people sailed with, both because his boat was far too small, but also because he was fond of animals, and he didn't like the idea of killing an animal that had been his sailing companion. So he didn't have any animals aboard, never had ever, until this goat. He said, "The mistake I made was that I didn't chain him to the mast instead of tying him with my grass ropes less securely. This I learned at my cost. Except for the first day, before the beast got its sea legs on, I had no peace of mind. After that, actuated by a spirit born maybe of his pasturage, this incarnation of evil threatened to devour everything from flying jib to stern davits. He was the worst pirate I met on the whole voyage. He began depredations by eating my chart of the West Indies in the cabin one day while I was about my work forward, thinking that the critter was securely tied on deck to the pumps. Alas, there was not a rope in the sloop proof against that goat's awful teeth." He could not bring himself to kill the goat, however. So he trussed him up. The next island landfall he had was on Ascension Island in the middle of the Atlantic, and so he marooned the goat on Ascension Island. So finally, on June 27th, 1898, he reaches Boston Harbor. And here's how he ends the telling of his tale. "I eased off the main sheet now, and the spray swung off for the beacon lights of the inner harbor. At last she reached port in safety, and there at 1 a.m. on June 27, 1898, cast anchor after the cruise of more than 46,000 miles around the world, during an absence of 3 years and 2 months with 2 days over. Was the crew well? Was I not? I profited in many ways by the voyage. I had even gained flesh, actually weighed a pound more than when I sailed from Boston. As for aging, why, the dial of my life was turned back till my friends all said, 'Slocum is young again.' And so I was, at least 10 years younger than the day I felled the first tree for the construction of Spray." And he closes the book with this. If the spray discovered no continents on her voyage, it may be that there were no more continents to be discovered. She did not seek new worlds or sail to powwow about the dangers of the sea. The sea has been much maligned. To find one's way to lands already discovered is a good thing, and the spray made the discovery that even the worst sea is not so terrible to a well-appointed ship. No king, no country, no treasury at all was taxed for the voyage of the spray, and she accomplished all that she undertook to do. To succeed, however, in anything at all, one should go understandingly about his work and be prepared for every emergency. I see, as I look back over my own small achievement, a kit of not-too-elaborate carpenter's tools, a tin clock, and some carpet tacks. Not a great many to facilitate the enterprise, as already mentioned in the story, but above all, to be taken into account were some years of schooling, where I studied with diligence Neptune's laws, and these laws I tried to obey when I sailed overseas. And now, without having wearied my friends, I hope, with detailed scientific accounts, theories, or deductions, I will only say that I have endeavored to tell just the story of the adventure itself. This, in my own poor way, having been done, I now moor ship, weather bit the cables, and leave the sloop spray for the moment safe in port. So he's arrived. There's a sad postscript, and we'll end with this. I've already mentioned that the book appeared in 1900. It sold well. Slocum augmented his royalty income with lectures, personal appearances. In 1902, he bought a small house in Martha's Vineyard, put Hetty there, but he continued to live aboard the Spray in New England waters and began to sail south to spend winters in warmer Caribbean waters. So he was basically alone. In the spring of 1905, 61 years old, battered by years at sea, suffering occasional mental lapses, he was hauled into court on a charge of statutory rape. He was acquitted of the charge and nevertheless accused, though, of indecent action, held in 42 days, and finally released. This seems to have sort of set him on the final course, because he continued his voyage south, and his friends noted that both he and his boat were growing old and slack. He was always a man who kept himself well. He kept his boat immaculate, and things were beginning to go to seed a little bit. On November 14th, 1909, he set sail from Vineyard Harbor and Martha's Vineyard, and neither he nor the Spray were ever seen again. He was 65 years old, and he disappeared along with his boat off the face of the earth. There's no evidence of any kind as to what happened to him. He simply vanished along with the Spray. Not even a, you know, scrap of wreckage or anything. One critic wrote a half century later, and I like this very much, which is why I chose this among all the things been written about him, acknowledging, of course, as everybody did, that the guy was an absolute master seaman. No matter what happened in the end, he was an absolute master seaman. But this is what this critic wrote. He was above all a courageous and tenacious confronter of life, a resolute battler with the elements, an asserter against a world he did not make. He had led not a comfortable life, perhaps, but one from which he demanded meaning. And I'd add, he also left us a very great book. So that's the story of Mr. Slocum.
Well, that's another wonderful story of much, I think, to learn from these stories of another time and place and the tenacity and patience that kind of guided their journey. Amazing. Yeah. I mean, if those two words from all the Antarctic stories, all the early explorers, I mean, they did things that are difficult for us to imagine.
Yeah, and in the Slocum case, in a way, just as Longfellow is an embodiment of a certain kind of Yankee spirit. Slocum embodies a certain part of the Yankee spirit, too. I mean, it's one of the reasons that he's so inspirational. This wasn't done with money, you know. The whole thing was done with his own hands and his mind. Immensely self-sufficient. You know, it was in this last thing he said, nobody was taxed. Sort of the libertarians.
Right.
Creed, but it's very Yankee. Yeah, very American.
Very much. So, and just the image of taking a standing wood and 13 months later building this really sturdy and beautiful and, I mean, this craft that it took him everywhere he wanted to go till he died in it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's quite an imagine. It's an amazing story. And thanks again, Richard.
Well, thank you, Carol.
For this wonderful episode of This Strange and Wonderful World here on Lopez Community Theater at KLOILP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. This has been a pre-recorded broadcast. And look forward to having you with us again in a couple weeks. And good morning to you.